Hi, I'm Chris Berube. This hour on Focus, it's all about the Supreme Court. The term is about to come to an end, and there are some potentially groundbreaking decisions that are about to be made. We'll talk with law professors Lisa McElroy and Daniel Hamilton. We'll discuss cases yet to be decided that are going to set new precedents for same-sex marriage, affirmative action, and genetic research. We'll talk about why it's rumored that the court might throw out the arguments they heard on Proposition 8, and we'll examine a case that could allow biotechnology companies to patent genetic material for the human body. We'll also discuss issues to do with drug-sniffing dogs, can they or can they not come on your porch, search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment, and a case that could require many of President Obama's appointed advisors to go before the Senate. Do you have questions about any of the cases currently before the Supreme Court? Join the conversation today on Focus on WILL. Coming up after the news. I'm Chris Berube. This is AM 580. You're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube. Today, we're discussing the Supreme Court. We're almost at the end of the 2012-2013 term for the High Court, and there are lots of potential blockbuster decisions yet to come down, including rulings about same-sex marriage, affirmative action, and the Voting Rights Act, among other issues. Joining us today to discuss the Supreme Court is Lisa McElroy, who is an associate professor of law at Drexel University, and she's joining us from Philadelphia. Good morning, Lisa.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Daniel Hamilton, who is the incoming dean at Boyd Law School at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. He's in Chicago today. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Chris.
Now, if you have any questions about the Supreme Court, about how it operates or what we should expect in the next few weeks, please give us a call during the show. We're here at 217-333-9455, or you can find us online, will-talk at illinois.edu, Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. So, Lisa, I'm going to start with you. We don't really know when the Supreme Court term ends, I guess, in any given year, but we can safely say that it's wrapping up at this point, right?
That's right. In recent years, they've always issued their last decisions sometime during the last week of June. And good money is on the last day being somewhere around the 26th or 27th. And in almost all cases, the court will decide all argued cases by that date. So we should have the word on affirmative action and gay marriage by then.
Now, it seems like we just have so many big cases that have yet to be resolved. We had a couple of very large ones that just wrapped up. Dan, does this seem like a particularly eventful year in the Supreme Court, or is this kind of par for the course in terms of recent caseloads for them?
Well, we'll find out in 2 weeks, I think.
Well, let's talk about a couple of cases that have been settled recently by the court. I'd like to start with Maryland versus King. And this is a case about whether the Fourth Amendment allows states to collect and analyze DNA from people who've been arrested and charged with serious crimes. And specifically, the question is not whether or not they should be collecting DNA from convicted criminals or from crime scenes. I mean, states already do that, but whether they can just collect DNA from people who have been arrested. Lisa, why is this a particularly interesting case?
Well, it's interesting for a number of reasons. And Justice Alito commented before the decision came down last week that he thought this was the most important criminal procedure case in decades. What this involves is the police not drawing blood or anything like that, but taking one of those Q-tip type things, it's called a buccal swab, and swabbing the inside of someone's cheek when they've been taken to the police station and arrested. And what we know is that certainly the police always take fingerprints, and very often they'll take a mugshot. We've seen those with Lindsay Lohan, for example. And so the question was, is taking this buccal swab going further than that, such that it would be unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment? And the big thing that happened here that was so objectionable by Mr. King was that when they took the swab, they didn't just use it for so-called identification purposes, but they actually put the DNA into a national database, into a state database, excuse me, and they were able to connect him to a rape that had been committed several years before but never solved. And, of course, based on that evidence, he was convicted of the rape. And so he said, this was going too far. You violated my constitutional rights.
Now, why would this, Daniel, why would this violate the constitutional rights under the Fourth Amendment? It seems like the argument being made is that it is an unreasonable search and seizure, I guess, to swab someone's cheek.
Well, Lisa's quite right. The question is this like fingerprinting and taking a photograph in which you're simply identifying a person under arrest, or is this a more fundamental kind of search and seizure of the person? So the Supreme Court said that it is not a search. So This goes into a database, even if there's not a trial, even if the person is later found innocent. And I should say the person at the time of their arrest is innocent, which is to say, under the criminal justice system, of course, they're innocent until proven guilty. So at that point, they're innocent. And the question is, can the state keep a database of someone alleged to have committed a crime that remains in that database forever? And I should say an interesting thing about this case is that Justice Scalia joined the liberal bloc, or at least much of the liberal bloc, in dissent in that case. So it shook up our normal understanding of left and right on the court.
And it's important also to note that one of Justice Scalia's key objections here, Chris, was that he thought that the majority was being a little bit facetious, or that they weren't really telling the whole truth, because he was saying that, you know, we aren't just using this DNA for identification purposes. We're actually using it to connect people to past crimes. And if you're going to do that, go ahead and say that that's what you're doing, but that's what you're doing here.
Yeah, I feel like this is one of those great kind of scorching Scalia dissents that came out. And it's so interesting to see him siding with, it was actually Justice Sotomayor, Justice Ginsburg, and Justice Kagan forming a very strange block in opposition to this for, I think, very different reasons. It's fair to say that they were opposed, right?
Sure, but I think it's really interesting that Justice Sotomayor, the former prosecutor, was against this as a police tool. Certainly as a prosecutor, she would have been wanting to solve crimes, but here she was being loyal to the Constitution, and I think that's what we see with Justice Scalia as well.
It's also just a classic Scalia dissent where he, you know, says the founding fathers never would have stood for the, you know, agents of the king swabbing their cheeks. So it's worth reading no matter how you stand on this issue.
So in terms of this as an intrusion, so they ruled that this was not an unreasonable seizure, that it was not that different from a fingerprint. And I guess the opposition to this in terms of the argument against it is that, well, no, this is not being used for identification purposes, because otherwise why, you know, airlines could have cheek swabs for identification purposes if they really wanted to make sure they had the right person. Like it kind of escalated into this. Well, why isn't everyone then getting cheek swabs to make sure that they have the right, you know, person doing what they're doing?
Sure. And one thing we always worry about with the law is the slippery slope. In other words, if you can do it at arrest for a serious crime, is it going to slide down the slope and eventually you can do it at arrest for, you know, someone who's not wearing their seatbelt? And then can you do it in an airport? And, you know, all of these questions are ones that would reasonably be raised.
Now, we have quite a few cases to get to. If you have a thought on the Supreme Court term or any questions about cases that are before the Supreme Court right now, give us a call, 217-333-9455, or you can get in touch with us online, will-talk@illinois.edu, on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. So I want to talk about another case that has been settled before the court. This is Clapper versus Amnesty International. And Dan, could you give us a sense of what this case was about?
Sure. Clapper is a case that turns on the interpretation of the 2008 amendments to the FISA court. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act creates a special court that meets in secret at the Justice Department that hears cases about intercepting communications from those overseas and those who are agents of foreign nationals, of foreign governments here in the United States. So this law, amended in 2008, gave the federal government much more authority to conduct searches without getting a warrant for at least a period of time, and it expanded greatly the kinds of people and the places where you could intercept communication. So in response to that, the ACLU sued, claiming that this was a violation of their constitutional rights. They were having their communications seized, and the court refused to hear the case on the merits. It wouldn't reach the merits of the case because it said that the ACLU couldn't show that they'd been injured. The ACLU couldn't show that they were in fact being listened to and that they were under surveillance. And the ACLU said, well, of course we can't testify that because the government won't tell us. And the government is under an obligation to tell you who they're listening to. So the overwhelming likelihood, however, is that we are being listened to, and we want to sue on that ground. And the court said, no, that's not enough injury. You've not shown that you've been injured enough to get into court. So that's a technical ruling, but it has very broad implications, because it might mean that the constitutionality of the law will never be heard in court, because no one will be able to show that they're actually the subject of the law, because the government won't tell them. So the Supreme Court said the ACLU's allegation that it was being listened to was too speculative. We just don't know, so we're not going to let you into the court to have the, hear the case on the merits. And that was a 5-4 decision, and I simply want to mention that, that assertion that it was too speculative has taken on a new light given the events of the last couple of weeks it's been leaked that the government is, in fact, involved in large-scale data mining of Verizon and other Internet service providers. So what the Supreme Court alleged was speculative in February is suddenly front-page news, and I very much doubt we've heard the end of this issue.
And if I can jump in here, people always think it's very funny that I'm as obsessed with the Supreme Court as I am. I'm a real Supreme Court junkie, and I always tell them that at the end of the day, everything comes back around to the Supreme Court. So, this week with all the NSA news, absolutely, we come right back around to Clapper.
So, yes, exactly. We're in the situation now where basically, do you think this case would have been decided differently if it had happened, if they'd been deciding it after the leak scandal broke? I'm going to throw this one to you, Dan.
The first answer is I don't know. The second answer is I wouldn't be surprised if it would have come out differently, which is to say it was a 5-4 decision. It's only one justice. And what looked speculative, the basis for their decision was that it was speculative on the part of the ACLU that they were being listened to. And now we have something like evidence that, in fact, there are massive data mining operations going on that have enormous reach. So what looks speculative in February does not look speculative in June. So if that's the question, bear in mind, is not how should the court rule on the decision. The question was, should the court hear the case at all? So I do think they are much more likely to hear it, and I think Lisa's right. I think they will hear a challenge based in large part on what's happening now.
So do you believe that some kind of case regarding wiretapping seems likely as something that might come before the court in the next term?
Yeah. I mean, the court has been very reluctant. This is one area where the court has been very deferential to the executive branch in terms of the war on terrorism and, in particular, surveillance. So it is hard to maintain now that a party can't show they've been the subject of this law. And that's the only question. So the court's strategy, I think, of avoiding reaching the merits on these kinds of national security cases is crumbling, and I think there will be a challenge that the court will hear, particularly if it goes to the circuit courts. And that's, of course, what drives a lot of Supreme Court cases, is once the circuit courts have conflicts between them.
I actually love the extremely Supreme Courtish language where they say that in terms of who they would be surveying, persons reasonably believed to be located outside the United States,
right.
And specifically people involved with foreign intelligence information. So that seems like one of those classically kind of broad, open to interpretation bits of language that says that this kind of surveillance is acceptable as long as, the burden of proof is, oh, we believed we were doing the right thing while we were doing it.
Yeah, and the court does use that kind of broad language very often. Sometimes when you see the broad language, it means that there's been a disagreement among the justices and that there's been some negotiating going on. How are we going to word this? Because, of course, every word that the court uses is scrutinized, particularly in this day of the 24-hour news cycle. And so, for example, we were just talking about Maryland v. King, the DNA case. They talked about serious offenses, and yet they never defined what a serious offense might be. And here, again, we reasonably believe them to be outside the state. Well, what exactly is that? And very often it's up to the lower courts to interpret that language and give it more definition.
You're listening to Focus on WYLL AM 580. My guests are Lisa McElroy, an associate professor of law at Drexel University, and Dan Hamilton, the incoming dean of law at Boyd Law School at UNLV. And we're discussing the Supreme Court term. And right now we're talking about a couple of cases that have been settled before the court. I do want to talk about Florida versus Jardines. This is a really interesting case to me. It's about drug-sniffing dogs, and it has to do with the Fourth Amendment because it's about unreasonable search and seizure. So basically what happened is the court was faced with two cases, one of which was an individual who had methamphetamines in his car, and drug-sniffing dogs, you know, figured out, like, they were around the car, they indicated to the police that there was something amiss in the car, and they found these methamphetamines. And then the second case was drug-sniffing dogs going up onto someone's porch and identifying marijuana inside the house. And the court had to make a decision about at what point is it not okay for drug-sniffing dogs or to be brought around someone's personal property like this. And what they ruled was that the car was reasonable, but the porch was not, because that was someone's private property. So it was not acceptable to have these dogs appear on the porch. Why is this such an interesting case, and what kind of a precedent does this set, Lisa?
Well, it's fascinating, first of all, because both cases were argued essentially together by one attorney, Greg Garr, who's the former Solicitor General of the United States. And everybody expected that they would come down together, that the court would decide them together. And instead, the court issued the decisions on separate days, and you're absolutely right, Chris, came to different conclusions in these two cases. And what we often do see the Supreme Court engaged in is this act of line drawing. For example, if you think back 10 years, there were the cases at the University of Michigan about affirmative action and admissions. Of course, we're going to be talking in a few minutes about the fact that there's another one of those cases at the court right now. But the court decided the two cases that seemed very similar differently. And here the court decided them differently as well because, again, there's always some line that you cannot cross. And you're absolutely right. They said, well, if they're sniffing around your car, that's probably okay. But once they get up to your home, and the court has said over and over again that the home is where we have the highest expectation of privacy. And in the case, they even said, you know what? This isn't even so much about the dog that's sniffing. This is about the behavior. This is about trying to go into somebody's home and find out what's going on without a warrant. And so to some extent, people should be comforted by the fact that, yes, they are very highly protected in their homes. On the other hand, when you're going through customs and they say you got to stop and let the dog sniff your luggage, court has said that kind of thing is absolutely okay.
This is such a weird case, too, because those dogs, I mean, there are anecdotal cases where drug-sniffing dogs have been wrong or have made potentially problematic errors where they, you know, smell an aromatic cheese in someone's bag and they think that it's drugs. But as you say, it doesn't particularly matter that it's dogs. It really is all about kind of privacy and the realm of privacy that people have, which is really kind of like a theme through the history of the Supreme Court, is determining how much privacy an individual has, right?
Absolutely. And we see that both in these Fourth Amendment cases about search and seizure. We certainly see them in the privacy type cases like marriage and abortion and procreation and so forth. So these issues come up again and again and again. And it certainly is interesting that sometimes dogs make mistakes. We should be really clear that what we're talking about is evidence coming in, right? So that if the evidence that a dog sniffed the bag and actually it was cheese, it wasn't drugs, of course that would be rebuttable. Somebody would be able to bring in evidence and say, hey, look, this was actually cheese that the dog was reacting to.
Now, in terms of the actual case itself, it says that the home is kind of a private sphere and people have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the home. I found that to be a really interesting decision because it also doesn't really consider the fact that, you know, a lot of people live in apartment buildings. And what if a dog outside of your apartment happens to catch the scent of marijuana? I mean, in that particular case, the hallway of an apartment building is kind of a public place, the same way that, you know, your car being on the street is in a public place.
Yeah, and I don't know, Dan, do you know? I don't think that they've taken this, certainly not with the dogs that far, but I'm not sure how halls are treated in apartment buildings. Do you know, Dan?
No, I think that they've not reached that. Yes, they've not reached that particular decision. I think what this turns on is the curious word curtilage, right? And curtilage is a word you hear only in Supreme Court cases about searches of your home, right? And the curtilage is the part of the house that is not inside the house. So it's the immediate surroundings around the house. And that apparently is protected. And that's interesting, right? We've seen the Supreme Court go in almost opposite directions in two big Fourth Amendment cases, 5-4 in Maryland versus King going one way and 5-4 in Florida v. Jardine going the other way. And it's a very complicated and very fact-specific area of the law, because we now know that for a car, what the court said is, a sniff is not a search. That was the famous line from the Carr case, a sniff is not a search. But for a house, or at least the curtilage of a private home, a sniff is a search. So we're talking about line drawing, and we're drawing really ever more fine lines and ever more, you know, fact-specific situations. And we haven't even reached technology. In other words, the ability to lurk inside a home now without setting foot on the property through infrared devices is really, I think, where the field is headed. And we don't know much about the law on that at all.
Well, of course, we do have Kylo from a bunch of years back where the police used these infrared goggles that weren't available to the public to look inside someone's home. That might tip us off.
You think it's going that way?
I don't know. But I do wonder, you know, if we think about it, and Dan, your observation I think is so interesting now that I'm thinking. So the home is too private, but the mouth is not too private. And last term, Justice Scalia went the other way on a case involving people who had been arrested and taken to jail and said it was okay to strip search them as part of the process of clearing people to enter the jail. And that was based on safety concerns. And so we do see these very fine lines and also these very, very fine points of reasoning why the court goes a certain way. And Dan, I know you probably share my view that the most important thing that someone that's learning about the law can learn is to really think about the why of the question. Why did the court decide this, not just what did the court decide?
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Focus on WYLL, and today we're talking about the Supreme Court. We have to take a break in a moment, but I quickly want to talk about Shelby County versus Holder, which is a case that has garnered a lot of attention about the Voters' Rights Act. Specifically, what happened in that case was that Shelby County in Alabama was arguing that a provision of the Voters' Rights Act that basically was trying to prevent places that had had a history of obstructing minorities from voting was no longer relevant in the year 2013. I mean, am I understanding that correctly as to what their argument was in that case, Dan?
Yeah. The question is Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional? So the Congress reauthorized that in 2006. That part of the law says that certain states and parts of other states need to have any change to their voting laws pre-cleared by the Justice Department on the basis of their history of discriminatory voting practices. And the states, and particularly Alabama, want to no longer be subject to this kind of pre-clearance. So we'll see. That reauthorization in 2006 was carefully constructed. And the 1965 Voting Rights Act is one of the hallmarks of the civil rights movement. So this could be a very emotional and very potentially important case in terms of election law in this country. And what was striking in this case, we, of course, are talking about Justice Scalia, who gives us all the best quotes every year. But what he said that drew a lot of attention, a lot of criticism during that oral argument was that this law, this part of this law, was part of the, quote, perpetuation of racial entitlement, unquote. And that was very controversial because it is, after all, simply trying to make sure that there's fair access to the vote in this country. So it is an emotional issue that is going to produce a great deal of strong emotion on both sides. And it looks as though, if I had to predict, it looks as though Justice Roberts is willing to try and overturn at least this part of the law. So that would be a major shift in American election law.
I mean, some people have even suggested this could be the end of the Voter Rights Act based on how the oral argument went down. It really seemed like Roberts and a number of other justices on the conservative side of the bench were really taking aim at, you know, just the whole premise of the act. Is that likely to happen? Is that actually a fair reading of it? And if so, what are the implications of that, Lisa?
Well, I think you're right that court watchers did feel that the Voting Rights Act case, Shelby County, was not going very well for the government, that Shelby County was likely to win on the merits of this case in saying we shouldn't have to do this preclearance thing anymore. I think that what we're seeing here, and Chief Justice Roberts has said, the only way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race, is a court that does not think that protections based on race necessarily need to be passed into law anymore, that affirmative action is outdated if it was ever constitutional, that voting protections are outdated if they were ever constitutional, And this term, together with the university admissions question about affirmative action, we could see some real blows to trying to prevent prejudice and discrimination. We don't know, but certainly that will be very, very emotional if it happens. And it's hard to say where that will take us. It might take us into a more colorblind society, but it also might take us to a society where people feel freer to discriminate.
You're listening to Focus here on WYLL AM 580. We're going to take a break in a moment. So far on the show, we've determined that your porch is your own domain, the inside of your cheek, maybe not so much. We have lots of interesting stuff coming up, including discussion about affirmative action and same-sex marriage. That's all coming up here on WYLL AM 580. Stay with us. You're listening to WYLL AM 580. This is Focus. I'm Chris Berube, sitting in today for Jim Meadows. My guests on today's show are Lisa McElroy, an associate professor of law at Drexel University, and Daniel Hamilton, the incoming dean at Boyd Law School at UNLV. Today we're talking about the Supreme Court term, which is winding up. We're getting a couple of blockbuster cases coming down the pike probably in the next few weeks. If you have any questions about what's been happening with the Supreme Court recently, about any of the cases that we're discussing on the show today, give us a call at 217-333-9455 or find us online. Send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu or Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And actually, we have had an email come in specifically from a listener named Steve, who says, could you ask your guests to talk about the University of Michigan admissions cases? I wonder if the logic in those decisions have been applied to all employment discrimination in addition to university admissions. And it's interesting he brings that up because one of the cases that we're waiting on with the Supreme Court right now is Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin, which actually, Lisa, could you give us some context about what that case is about?
Sure. And I think your listener is right to relate the admissions case that we have now to the Michigan cases from 10 years ago.
These are affirmative action cases, essentially.
That's right. So we have a case out of Texas. The University of Texas has had this 10% plan, whereby if you are in the top 10% of your high school class, you're automatically admitted to the University of Texas. And they've been doing this in part to try to achieve some diversity. Of course, that's not the only way you can get into the University of Texas. And Abigail Fisher, who brought this case, said, well, the reason I was denied was because I was white, and students of color who had not the qualifications, not the numbers that I did, were admitted in my place. And so the question in this case is, can you use affirmative action in university admissions? And if so, was it appropriate for the University of Texas to do so here, given that they had already achieved some diversity? And, of course, these cases go back to 10 years ago when we had two different cases that seemed pretty similar. We had the Gratz case involving undergraduate admissions, and the court said that plan at the University of Michigan undergraduate program was not okay because they essentially used quotas. They essentially had target numbers they were trying to use in terms of achieving diversity. But in the Grutter case, the companion case at the law school, the court said, well, here they were just using race as a factor in university admissions. It wasn't like they were trying to hit some number, and that's okay. Now, Fisher seems to take up pretty much that same question. And in fact, I was in the front row at the court on the day that Fisher was argued, and all of us sort of gasped because about 1 minute into the argument, Justice O'Connor, who wrote the Grutter decision, walked in and sat, and she sort of stared at the bench. And you just wondered, did she think her legacy was being undone?
Now, it's interesting, the Fisher case. Basically, the University of Michigan cases determined that, yes, race can be used basically a little bit as
right.
a factor in university admissions. And what's happening here, some people are wondering if the Abigail Fisher case is necessarily the right case to be arguing this on, because there have been discoveries that Abigail Fisher maybe was not the upstanding student that she was presenting herself at, or that there were other students who were minorities who also weren't admitted whose marks were about equivalent to hers. What do you think is going to happen with this case, Dan?
What my prediction for this case?
Well, do you think that this is going to be a situation where O'Connor's legacy is being undone, or is that under any kind of threat here?
I do think that Abigail Fisher is going to win. The question is, to what extent is she going to win? So I think that the court has to decide, as Lisa points out, how vigorously they want to take on Grutter and Gratz from 2003. So there are certainly some votes on the court who want to rip it out root and branch and decide that any race consciousness on the part of the state is unconstitutional. That would be a total rejection of Grutter. That would reverse O'Connor's carefully crafted compromise in that case, where she said that race could be a factor. It was important to promoting a critical mass of minority students in public higher education that promoted diversity, and diversity promoted all these different social goals like learning from one another and preparing for leadership in society. So that could be at risk. In other words, the ability to look at race at all, even as part of holistic review. Now, if I had to predict, I would say the court is not going to go that far. The court is not going to, if you ask me, totally reject the Grutter settlement. I do think they are going to rule that the Texas law is unconstitutional, that it relied on race too much and in too formulaic a fashion. But I think, if I had to guess, this will be limited to Texas alone. They're going to reach for a compromise that will affect the Texas law and maybe cabinet to Texas alone. If it doesn't, if it goes the other way, it could reach affirmative action everywhere in areas in higher education and potentially beyond higher education. So this really is the great unsettled question that could have a dramatic social impact depending on what the court wants to do.
And I think Dan just described that so beautifully. I couldn't have put it that well. I think one additional thing that we need to keep in mind here is that there will only be 8 justices involved in the decision. Justice Kagan is recused, presumably because of her work while she was Solicitor General. And so one of the votes that we might predict would uphold the affirmative action plan will not be there. And so many people are concerned about that.
Dan, I wonder what kind of an effect this will have on public universities, depending on how the ruling comes down. We're here at the University of Illinois. I mean, what kind of an effect would this have for an admissions policy at a school like this?
Well, if they decide on a broad overruling of Grutter v. Bollinger, then that would effectively eliminate the ability to be conscious of race at all in higher education admissions, which would drastically affect the admissions practices at almost every public, I don't want to say, at the majority of public universities in this country, certainly including the University of Illinois. So right now, admissions offices and general counsels of universities all over the country are looking at the court very carefully because it could almost immediately affect the composition of the incoming class, not just this year, but every year. And it would dramatically change the student body at the University of Illinois and many, many other schools, thousands of different kinds of entities around the country. And in particular, if it went beyond higher education, if the state couldn't look at race at all, then, and Lisa is quite right, it'll be curious to see where they draw that line, if they do draw a line, then it could reach into multiple aspects of life. So it depends on if the court has the stomach for a big, wrenching, socially divisive issue. Now, I'll go a little bit afield. I'll be very curious what Lisa thinks on this. I don't know if the court has the stomach for that fight, and it might be that this case will show us how to interpret last term's health care law, where the court stepped back from the brink of a hugely divisive social issue, the health care, Obamacare. And I predict they're going to do that in this case, that the court is trying not to get out ahead of public opinion, and it's still licking its wounds from cases like Citizens United and Bush v. Gore. But that could be wrong. I just think the court is not poised to make another. I think the court is going to act in line with its health care decision of last year and not upset a sort of socially arrived at middle ground on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with Dan that the court is very, very concerned about its image as an institution. And it's very interesting. A couple of days ago, my 12-year-old daughter asked me, why do people listen to what the courts say? Why don't they just ignore it? And I laughed and told her that was a very... That was a very profound question, and that those of us in academia often ask each other that question. The court isn't going to want to be seen as an activist. They're going to want to be seen as a reasonable institution. And so I agree with Dan that if they're going to go great guns here, they're going to risk some of that respect and that legitimacy, and particularly where presumably in the same week or two-week period they're going to be deciding the gay marriage cases, and these are both two hugely, hugely important social justice type issues.
You're listening to Focus on WYLL AM 580. Today we are discussing the Supreme Court and the term, which is just running out. We have a few more big cases to get to, but first I'd like to get to the phone lines. David from Urbana is joining us now. Hello, David.
Yes, I have a speculative question. For the sake of argument, let's assume that the next president elected will be a liberal, and that they nominate one, or more importantly, two Supreme Court justices replacing conservatives. What is the probability of a reversal of some of the 5-4 decisions of the recent years?
Thank you very much, David. Lisa and Dan, what do you think about this question about bringing in new Supreme Court justices?
Well, absolutely. If a liberal president were able to replace justices on what we tend to call the conservative wing of the court, certainly the court could agree to hear some cases that would then serve to overrule past decisions the court has made. For example, we saw this with late-term abortion, to some extent with Citizens United, and certainly those things could be undone as well by a future court. But the court does care deeply, deeply, again, about respect for the institution, legitimacy, and that concept of precedent. And so the court tends to tread fairly carefully, particularly when it's overruling itself on a case that's very recently decided. Dan, would you agree?
Yes. I think also that we have to always bear in mind who can get confirmed in this day and age.
Right.
That even if there's a liberal president and someone from the conservative bloc dies or retires, it's very tricky to get people through the confirmation process given the filibuster in the Senate. So you are not able to really appoint people anymore at either end of the ideological spectrum. So the court sort of has a bigger middle than it used to, a center-right-ish court. So I don't think you could get someone through who would want to take on in a fundamental way sort of root and branch all these major decisions out there. I do think where you saw 5-4 decisions going one way, you probably see them go the other way, right? So that could include things like Citizens United and the First Amendment case, and I think cases like the gay marriage case, which we're going to talk about, and the affirmative action case, we'd be much more certain about how those kinds of cases would come out. But having said that, those are famous last words, right? Because justices switch, they flip. So Justice Souter was famous for going from one side of the spectrum to the other. So it's hard to predict. Even once they're on the court, they change their behavior once they're on the court frequently. They have life terms, and they influence one another in ways that are interesting to watch. There are 9 people sitting around a table in a room, and they affect each other in ways that are very, very difficult to predict.
And those 9 people can really only talk to their 8 colleagues. It's a very, very weird job, and that Dan and I can talk to people everywhere, you know, via a listserv or a conference or something. When they're deciding these cases, they can only talk to each other, and we do see huge evolution over the course of their careers, particularly if you think that many of them serve for 20, 30 years. I mean, I know I'm a very, very different person than I was 20 years ago.
And, of course, the confirmation question is such an interesting one because we've seen President Obama having trouble getting anyone confirmed to any court, basically because of the filibuster and various numbers of issues. We don't have a lot of time left, so I do want to get to what might be the biggest case, or at least the case with the most public interest coming down, which is Proposition 8, and specifically relating to California's law that bans same-sex marriage. Many, many questions came up out of the oral argument from that. Where are we at with that case right now, Lisa?
Well, where we're at with it is that there are a few different things that could happen here. The first thing is that the court could say there is a fundamental right to marry, in the Constitution, and we have to apply a very strict standard called strict scrutiny. And under that strict scrutiny standard, we have to let gay people get married. Another thing that could happen is they could say, well, gay people are a protected class, and so we have to use heightened scrutiny when looking at laws that discriminate against them. And finally, one last thing that could happen that a lot of people are talking about is very much like in Clapper, the court could say, look, the wrong party brought this case. It was Prop 8 supporters who brought this case. They can't show that they've been harmed, and the court could refuse to decide just based on the issue of standing about whether the right party brought the case.
Yeah, it seems like during oral arguments around Proposition 8, a lot of the interesting questions, especially I remember Justice Kagan brought this up, was should we have even taken this case on in the first place? Dan, why did that question come up so often?
Well, because we're in the very unusual situation where the executive branch will not defend a law on the books that they think, that President Obama thinks is unconstitutional. So the question was, who could appeal the decision to the Supreme Court? So the Solicitor General, who argues cases on behalf of the federal government, is arguing against an existing federal law. So it's a very curious decision. It's a very curious moment where the Obama administration, quite rightly, in my view, I should say, has decided that there's a law on the books, the DOMA law, the Defense of Marriage Act, that is unconstitutional, so it won't defend it in court. So the case almost died there before a group of House Republicans decided, no, we will defend this law, the Defense of Marriage Act, in federal court. And the question is, do they have standing? Are they sufficiently tied to this case that they can represent the government in court? And if they don't want to reach the merits of this case, that is how they will, I think, that's one way they can easily avoid it, at least when it comes to the federal challenge, because there's two challenges here. There's a challenge to a federal law, the Defense of Marriage Act, and there's a challenge to a state law, a state constitutional provision, Proposition 8 in California. And they're somewhat different, and they give the court different avenues to go. The California case is much more on the merits of same-sex marriage itself. In other words, is it constitutional to say that marriages exist only between men and women? The federal law is different. The federal law says marriage is defined as for a man and woman, as a man and a woman, for purposes of federal benefits. So one case goes to the actual merits of gay marriage, the legality of gay marriage, and the other goes to how benefits are provided. So the court has lots of options to hear whatever parts of this it wants to hear.
What's so interesting about this is we were talking about kind of getting behind public opinion a little bit and how the Supreme Court has had a complicated relationship with decisions like Citizens United and Bush v. Gore, which ended up being very publicly controversial. It seems like opinion has moved so quickly on same-sex marriage in this country that it really puts them in kind of an impossible situation a little bit. Lisa, would you say that's fair?
Well, nothing's impossible at the Supreme Court, and what we have to remember is that these people can really do whatever they want, and they can find justification for doing whatever they want. And it's really hard to say, well, you did that wrong, because they're kind of the final word. But the court is also always behind. The court is always behind society. You were asking before about technology cases and infrared searches and that kind of thing. And, you know, the court, you know, as recently as a couple of terms ago, wasn't quite sure what a text message was. You know, they're in what some people call the Marble Palace on the Hill. A lot of these justices are older, and they don't really keep up with society too well. So it may be that the time has just not come for them and gay marriage. It may be that 10 years down the road may be a better time. And in fact, we saw that with the cases that criminalized sodomy laws. In the 1980s, the court just, you know, they didn't get it. And then 17 years later, the court had become educated and changed its mind. It may be that some of these technology things, for example, we've got a big gene patenting case this term, and some of these cases about sort of contemporary society need to play themselves out a little bit longer.
Let's actually talk about gene patenting, because this is a case that is moving so quickly. It's so interesting. It's specifically called the Association of Molecular Pathologists versus Myriad Genetics. And the case is about a biotech company that's been isolating genes and doing work to try to find a cure for breast cancer. And they wanted to patent a strand specifically that they had isolated. And it's so interesting because apparently 41% of the genes in the genome have been patented at this point. This could be a really slippery case. Dan, what are kind of the implications of this case?
Well, can you patent part of the human body is the question. And the company maintains we're not, so you can't patent, of course, the heart or parts of nature because you didn't invent them. The question in a patent case is what did you invent? And you don't invent nature. What the company is maintaining here is that we are not patenting the gene itself. We're patenting the process to get to isolate the gene. And once we invest enormous amounts of resources, I think they claim that they spent something like, this company spent $500 million as part of this research, they can then make money by doing profiling to determine if people are susceptible to certain kinds of diseases and cancers. But the opponents say this is effectively patenting the human body, which you can't do, and it's effectively saying that different parts of the body belong to different private companies, and these should be part of the public domain to promote research into something as fundamental as the human body. But these drug companies maintain that the only incentive we have to spend $500 million to isolate this gene is if we're going to have some payoff at the end, and this kind of important research simply won't happen. So if you want to talk about areas that are leaving sort of all of us, particularly the Supreme Court, which, as Lisa says, is famously technologically behind the times, this is very uncharted territory. And I leave it to the scientists to determine how sweeping this might be. But just to a layperson, we almost can't understand it without breaking it down into certain kinds of analogies. And you can see the Supreme Court trying to turn the science into something it and I and all of us can understand. But this could be the sleeper of the term. This could be where some, you know, where 50 years from now, this was the moment when a major paradigm shift took place in our, I don't want to get too existential, but into our conception of the body and human being.
It's so interesting. One of the organizations that's involved in arguing this case has been the ACLU. Lisa, why have they been involved in arguing against this patenting of genes?
Well, if you think about it, and I think Dan was very, very articulate in explaining the patent system. The patent, if you have a patent, that's also called intellectual property. And if you think about the concept of a human being or part of a human being being property, that's really repulsive to us, especially, you know, we hope after the Civil War, right? And so if we have somebody owning this gene, it really takes away certain freedoms, doesn't it? And it might impair other companies' abilities to do the same kind of research because they can't work on these genes anymore. I think that this really, really was highlighted a couple of weeks ago when Angelina Jolie published her op-ed in the New York Times about the difficulties she's had with mutations of the breast cancer gene. And that's exactly what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with real people and whether a cure will be found for them or not. And if someone owns this particular genetic strand, it may be only they who can find a cure.
Now, we also bring up Elena Kagan during this argument mentioned that the patent office is, in her words, kind of patent happy. What she was saying is that the patent office maybe gave patents on this, you know, 41% of the genome because that's what they do. They give patents. They don't really think about these broader issues. Dan, do you think that that could actually change, like, how we view patents and intellectual property in this country?
Well, there's no avoiding it. In other words, the science is moving in this direction and the technology is coming, and it is so bizarre that the patent office might be the one that determines what parts of the human body can be owned and not. So I think this is an area where the Supreme Court has to try and give us some guidance because the patent office is just not equipped to make these kinds of big scientific sort of determinations. And this is one where the law as a social institution is behind the science, and we don't even have a language for talking about this yet. So this is going to be happening more and more, and we are in the very early stages of what's going to be a fundamental fight. Because Lisa's right. I mean, what can be owned? To what extent can the components of human life be owned such that you can own parts of an embryo or a fertilized egg and parts of the body? This is all coming to the Supreme Court. There's no getting around it. And this is an interesting question also for us and as court watchers because we have no idea, I don't think, of the ideological content of these, of this issue yet. We don't know how it breaks on a left-right question. We don't know how anyone's going to vote. And so it's just fascinating.
It is completely and totally fascinating. And I think it's also fascinating when we're talking about the patent office not being equipped to make these kinds of decisions. What's so interesting to me is that the Supreme Court, the justices are what we call generalists. They know, you know, maybe a couple of them know a little bit more about some particular area of the law, but none of them were patent specialists before they went up on the court. And in fact, we have a special federal court that deals with these kinds of things so that we can have people with expertise in this area. So in a way, you know, we have these people who don't know very much about technology and presumably don't know about this biotechnology who will be making very, very important decisions simply based on sort of the legal philosophy around them.
And I'm afraid that we're going to have to wrap it up there. We're going to be hearing about many of these cases in the next couple of days, possibly in the next couple of weeks. And of course, we'll keep you posted on WYLL about their status. Lisa McElroy is an associate professor of law at Drexel University. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It was a great discussion.
And Dan Hamilton is the incoming dean at Boyd Law School at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Dan, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to Focus here on WILL. Join us again tomorrow, and we'll be discussing a censorship controversy at a West Central Illinois art gallery. I'm Chris Berube. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft was our technical director. To find our show online, you can visit us on Twitter at Focus580 and at will.illinois.edu. You're listening to WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.